Before we dive in, just a quick favor. If you're enjoying what we're doing at Angels Among Us, please take a second to rate and review the show. And if something in today's episode touches your heart, please share it with a friend. Welcome to Angels Among Us, the podcast where we share real stories of angelic encounters. Each episode, you'll hear firsthand accounts of divine protection, guidance, and miraculous interventions that remind us we're never truly alone. Whether through a whisper of comfort, an unseen hand of protection, or an unmistakable presence, angels are closer than we think. Join us as we explore these powerful experiences of angels, both seen and unseen. Hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of Angels Among Us. Brent and Michaela here as usual. And we're going to let Michaela do the introduction today.
Yep. So we have here Miss Heather Henredick. So Heather is, it's kind of a funny story. So I actually grew up with Heather's stepsister, Jenny, and Carrie. And we were, I don't even know how much younger we are than you, but I never really got to see you.
We look older than she does.
A model. But I know that you are a little bit older, but my mom actually worked with your dad in the hospital. So Heather's dad was a doctor, and so very fun family. But how we got connected was through one of our friends. So Annie is Heather's other stepsister. Weird connection. But Annie was like, you have to hear Heather's story. You have to get her on the podcast. So we are so excited, Heather, to hear your story. And I know it's going to help so many people. So go ahead and introduce yourself and get started.
Thank you. So I would be remiss if I didn't let you know that my name is actually Heather Henredick O'Day. Husband would would probably kill me. I am the chief development officer and one of the partners at Ocean Recovery. And yeah, I've got a pretty, you know, exciting intense story, that's for sure. Probably don't look like the kind of person that dealt with the things that I dealt with. And so I'm hoping if anything, somebody hears this or sees this, can identify with just a tiny piece of my story, and that it can help them.
I've learned that even though we haven't gone through the exact same things, we can relate with trials and issues and maybe feelings throughout those things, and hopefully somebody's going through something similar and they can recognize the angels in their life.
Yeah. I guess, you know, I want to start off with just telling a little bit about my background. I'm from a small little town in Washington State. I had a wonderful family. I had a family of high achievers. And I think there was a level of unsaid expectation that I felt my entire life that I think probably helped contribute to what happened later in my life. But I had a very loving home. For the most part, I had two parents in the home until my parents divorced when I was in high school. As a little girl, I wasn't very girly. I had two brothers. I had an older brother and a younger brother who was quite a bit younger than me. I was kind of a tomboy, and I played a lot of sports. And that kept me really busy. I played club soccer, tennis. I danced. I ski raced in the winters. And so I was a very busy person. And I think, looking back, I think being busy probably, kept me from reaching a bottom a lot sooner than I did. But, you know, in, in middle school and high school, I would say that I was a run-of-the-mill student. I was probably more of on the high-achieving side. I tended to be in all honors. I played two varsity sports all through high school. I played number one singles on our tennis team.
Wow.
I played on our varsity soccer team all 4 years. And then, again, the other seasons, I was kept pretty busy. I chose to go to kind of our a high school that was not very close to where I lived, because they had an international baccalaureate program, which is kind of an honors program where you can get college credits, and it's kind of like AP, but. My older brother went there, and I really idolized him a lot growing up. And so I decided to kind of follow his footsteps. And I did, I made it through high school as probably most kids do. I experimented a little bit with substances. Pot probably being the strongest substance I used. I would drink occasionally on the weekends with my friends, but again, I was very, very busy. And because I was so busy, and because there was a lot of expectation put on me, I really kind of strived to achieve those things. And I didn't really have time to, party a lot on the weekends. I was going to soccer tournaments. When it was time for college, my older brother went to a small liberal arts college in Washington called Whitman College. And I used to go visit him. And I loved the energy that I felt there, and I felt like I belonged. And so when it was time for me to decide where to go to school, it was a pretty easy decision for me. And I applied early decision to Whitman, and I got in. I spent the next 4 years of my life in college. I had an incredible college experience. It's a small school. Everybody who went to Whitman is kind of a high achiever. It is extremely academically rigorous, and so I studied along with my fellows during the week, and on the weekends we partied. But we always got our papers in, and there wasn't a lot of time for skipping school. I had 10 other students in my class, so if you skipped school, the teacher knew you were out of the classroom. You didn't get away with, in fact, you would probably run into him or her on the quad on the way to your next class, and they would ask why you weren't in school. And so I say all these things as a setup just to say that, I was kept very busy and didn't have a lot of time to feel. But what I can tell you about my childhood is that I always felt different. I never felt like I got the playbook that everybody else got on how to do life on life's terms. And I also feel like I had a God-shaped hole in my soul my entire life. I did not grow up with a very spiritual family. My dad was Jewish. My mom was Christian. And we celebrated a little bit of everything. But nobody in my family was exceptionally spiritual. And nobody really had a connection with a higher power. And so that wasn't really something that came naturally to me. And I think that looking back, I think there was a longing for me not only to belong, but also to know something greater than myself that I never had. And so back to college. My junior year of college, I decided I was going to study abroad. And I chose to study in Italy, in Florence, Italy.
Wow.
And before I left, my brother, who was very loving, but also, an older brother, said to me, "Don't get fat over there." Because everybody who studied abroad, came back a good 20 to 50 pounds overweight. It was just kind of what you did. And for some reason, that phrase, don't get fat, stuck with me. And I made it my one and only goal while I was in Italy. I was not going to get fat. And so what that meant when I got there, I lived with a wonderful host family who, that my mom was a professional chef, and she would have cooking class in, our apartment every day. And then we would eat the stuff that they would cook. But I was so scared to gain weight, that I just was not eating. And over the course of the 6-ish plus or minus months that I was in Italy, I got skinnier and skinnier. And by the time I got back, you know, I was probably 20 pounds skinnier than people were probably used to seeing. Again, I was an athlete for most of my life. I really didn't worry about weight. It wasn't something I ever even thought about. When I got back from school, things slowly started to become unmanageable. And what had started as restricting slowly turned into full-blown bulimia, where I was throwing up after most of my meals. I was able to graduate college on time. You know, I loved Whitman College, and I got an amazing education, but I wasn't given a lot of direction with what I wanted to do with my life. I was taught a little bit about a lot of things, but I thought maybe I wanted to go to law school, but I wasn't quite sure. And so I decided I was going to move to California for a year and kind of figure it out, you know, do life outside of Washington State, you know, and really kind of figure out what I wanted to do. During this time, my eating disorder was kind of becoming worse and worse. My friends and family were extremely concerned about me, and you know, it was brought to my attention often. But I, you know, I hid it on the inside, because it had kind of become my coping mechanism for dealing with life that became super, super overwhelming for me. After about a year in living in Santa Barbara, California, you know, I'd found a great job, and was working, but I was spending what little money I had on food. And I was bouncing checks, and I pretty soon found that, my life just became completely unmanageable. It was also during this time, I had a root canal and had to get kind of some oral surgery. And for the first time ever, I was prescribed opiates and pain medication. And I'll never forget the first time I took the pain medication. I felt for the first time in my entire life I could breathe. I felt like, oh my gosh, this is what I've been looking for my entire life. Again, that feeling of like not being okay, that not feeling a part of, that always kind of feeling on the outside. This pill changed all of that for me. And from then on, I in addition to my eating disorder, that was kind of running rampant, I, you know, did everything I could to kind of find painkillers, to get prescribed painkillers, whether it was doctor shopping, whether it was stealing them from friends' homes, from friends' families. I reached a point in California where my life was really becoming unmanageable. I was behind on rent. I was, you know, bouncing checks here and there. I couldn't pay my bills, and I decided enough is enough. I can't live this way anymore. So I called my parents and I told them that I had bulimia, and that I'd had an eating disorder for a couple years, and that I really wanted to do something about it. So my mom flew down and packed up all my stuff, and we drove back to Washington State, and we picked an eating disorder program. And a couple weeks later, I was shipped off for 90 days to an eating disorder program in Missouri. During this time, I was constantly getting in trouble for, you know, I had snuck pot in to the program because for some reason I thought that was a good idea. When it got to the point where I was allowed to go out on outings or rent a car and do or and do what I you know, I'd go to the liquor store and I would buy you know, multiple shooters and I would come back intoxicated. And the clinical team decided that I also had a substance abuse problem. You know, my initial response was, "Oh my gosh, you're crazy." And they wanted to keep me longer. By the end of the 90 days, I was feeling a lot better. I was up to a healthy weight. But they really wanted me to stay. And they told my parents it was probably a good idea if I did stay. But I, you know, I kicked, I screamed, like I always had my entire life. I convinced my parents that I was just fine. And I went home to Washington State, where I didn't really have a plan. I didn't have any aftercare. And I was left kind of right back where I started with I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. When I got back to Washington, because my eating disorder had taken a back seat, the substances came rushing in. And it just so happens that Yakima was a really easy place for me to find those substances. And what started as, you know, dabbling with painkillers, a little bit of cocaine here and there, over the course of, you know, I would say 5 or 6 years and a lot of jobs and whatnot. I was introduced to crack cocaine and heroin. And by this time, you know, I was unemployed. I was living alone, and I decided that, you know, I don't think I can really ever live my life without substances. And I was just going to go all in. It was at around this time that I was introduced to a pretty notorious drug dealer in my hometown of Yakima. He was a good 20 to 30 years older than me. I remember the first time that I met him. I showed up in his double wide trailer, kind of down in the bad part of Yakima. He was wearing his tighty whities. He was probably 400 pounds. There was porn on 24/7 in the background. And you know, I think I showed up to buy a little bit of crack, and before I knew it, 2 days had gone by. And I couldn't even account for the 48 hours. And you know, at that point in time, I decided to dive in. And what that meant was, I abandoned my house. I allowed my pets to be kind of taken by neighbors. My mom took one of my dogs, and I moved into the crack house with this crack dealer, and I'll call him Bob. Bob was extremely abusive, both physically and emotionally. He was dealing a lot of both cocaine and heroin out of the double wide that I had moved into. I had transitioned from snorting the heroin to using it intravenously. And I spent the next, I think, almost 2 years of my life in that crack house.
Heather, can I just ask a question really quick?
Yeah.
Did your parents know at this time what was going
yeah
on? Okay.
yeah so you know, my parents, you know, it obviously it didn't go from, you know, the occasional drug use to all of a sudden I had a needle in my arm. There was a couple years of progression during that time, where, you know, friends of mine reached out to my parents saying they were really concerned about me and my drug use. You know, I you know, they would have conversations with me. I was kind of really good at pulling the wool over their eyes until I wasn't, and I didn't care. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was also during this time that my mom, you know, it was really hard for her to reckon with the fact that her, you know, beautiful college educated daughter had become a heroin addict and was living in a crack house down the street. You know, her house was up on the ridge, and from her balcony, she could see the roof of the crack house that I lived in down in the distance. And so, you know, to reconcile with that, my mom started a blog. And she started to reach out to other parents of addicts and other professionals who could kind of guide her. She started going to Al-Anon. And so, you know, because she had started going to Al-Anon, I knew that I couldn't call my parents for money. And I had stopped doing that quite a while before. And so there really wasn't much they could do but kind of love me from afar. I heard a lot of funny stories about friends wanting to come, you know, take their gun and rescue me from the crack house and, you know, all sorts of ways that they could kind of get me from the disease and from that place. But I think what they really knew is that this was something I needed to want myself. To be honest with you, I thought that my life, that's what all my life was going to amount to. And I know it's hard to believe. But I could not imagine my life without numbing. I think because I had been numbing for so long, from in one way or another, I could not imagine my life without substances. And I had gone so far down kind of the depths of despair that I didn't see a way out. I didn't know how to do it. And I thought I would probably die in that crack house, to be perfectly honest with you. You know, it was also during this time I was in and out of jail. I was caught multiple times shoplifting. I was put on probation. Never bother checking in with your probation officer or my probation officer, because what do you say? they drug test you and you have to follow you know, pretty strict guidelines, and I was living in a crack house. You know, during this time, what I didn't know was that we were being watched by the Yakima Police Department for quite a while. And one morning I woke up to about 30 Yakima SWAT members that barged in. I was laying in bed, half naked, and I woke to, you know, four rifles pointed at my head. You know, in addition to drugs, my crack dealer boyfriend Bob also dealt guns, and so there were a lot of weapons in the house at the time. And so when we were raided, there were there were drugs, there were weapons. There was always people kind of in and out of the house because, you know, we were supplying a lot of Yakima with their substances. And so at that time, I think there were probably 6 to 8 people arrested. I remember I was handcuffed and walked down the stairs after I was clothed. The Yakima police officer said to me, "Must be love, huh?" Because he looked over and there was my 400-pound, POS boyfriend in his tidy whities kind of being handcuffed down the stairs. I got to be honest with you, in my mind, I truly felt like I loved this man. He kept me alive, I felt like. There was a huge part of me that felt like I was in love with this person. I, even though I had been arrested multiple times in the past, I wasn't arrested at this time. Our life kind of got thrown into a whirlwind because we stopped doing drugs or dealing drugs out of the house. And when you stop dealing drugs, you know, my resources kind of dried up. And so it's one thing to get punched in the face on a daily basis from somebody who's getting you high. But it's another thing to get punched in the face when you're dope sick. And so I want to stop here and say that I think this is the first time really looking back that God truly revealed himself to me. And there's a series of events that happened that allowed me to leave that crack house and choose another way of life. The first is that I would say about 5 days prior to me leaving, I didn't have a phone at the time. You know, this is back in between 2008 and 2010. I didn't have a smartphone. I did have a cell phone, but it was a phone that you had to put minutes on, and I didn't have minutes on my phone. Very occasionally, I would put minutes on. And I happened to have put some minutes on my phone, and my phone rang, and it was a number I didn't recognize. And I answered it, and the guy on the other end of the phone said, "Heather, this is Todd DeGrasse." Now, Todd was kind of an old high school friend, wasn't somebody I was particularly close to, but somebody I knew. And I remember kind of being really baffled why he was calling me or how he even got my number. But he said, "Heather, I know what you're doing." He said, "I think you've gone down this road about as far as you can go." And I don't know what it was, but for the first time in my life, I stopped to contemplate what it was I was doing. I think everybody kind of pussyfoot around the fact that I had been living in this crack house, had become a heroin addict. Nobody actually took me by the arms and shook me and said, "What are you doing?" And there is something that compelled him to make the call that day. But it was the first of a series of events that got me thinking in my mind, what am I doing? And he's right. I can't get any lower than I am right now. The second, was that, you know, like I had said before, we had been raided by the SWAT team. So, the drugs were kind of few and far between. When I moved into the crack house, I didn't have a lot of personal effects with me. I grabbed some clothes, and that's about it. But the one thing that I did have was my blanket, my baby's blanket that, I'd been given to when I was born by my grandmother. I slept with it every day of my life. And for some reason I decided I wanted to bring it to the crack house with me. And I did. Bob used to torment me with this blanket. He used to threaten to burn it. He would hide it from me. And one day, this was a couple days after the phone call. You know, I was dope sick a lot of the time. I was home. He had come home, was in a really bad mood. And so I decided I would hide my blanket underneath the cushions of the bed so that he couldn't find it. And he was huffing and puffing about something and said, "I'm going to burn your blanket." And I kind of sassed off to him and I said, "Well, you have to find it first." And he backhanded me very hard. And I landed on the ground, and for the first time in my life, I decided, what the heck am I doing? What am I doing? I cannot live this way. Like, I'm going to die here. And something just compelled me to get up And I grabbed his phone. I didn't have a, you know, I grabbed his phone. I locked myself in the bathroom and I decided that was enough. I decided that was it. And I called my dad and I said, okay, I'm done. I'll go to treatment. And it took a couple days for them on the back end to coordinate everything. And 3 days later, I was on a plane for Orange County, California. And you know, the first day of my recovery journey was May 9th, 2010. And I was sent to an all women's, treatment center in Costa Mesa, California, where I spent 90 days in residential treatment. I, you know, during that time, I experienced very little, questioning of, did I want to be there? I think the hell that I had lived in every day was so beyond that. Every day I was outside of that living hell was like an absolute miracle. And I, you know, I was extremely grateful to be out of that environment and really kind of give my body and my brain a chance to kind of heal itself after the years and years of substance abuse, of eating disorder abuse, of just numbing myself. I completed, 90 days of treatment. I moved into sober living. I did everything that was asked of me. You know, I didn't question. I got a sponsor. You know, at 6 months sober, the owner of the treatment center, told me I needed to get a job. And so she told me that, you know, to suit up and to show up the next day. And I was going to be support staff at the treatment center that I had gone through. And so I did that. And I did that every day for about 2 years, to be honest with you. You know, now I was 30 by the time I got sober. I was a lot older than most of the women I was in treatment with. I had more life experience. I had more work experience. But this was kind of what they call a get well job. And I was giving back to the women, just like the women who are in treatment were giving back to me on a daily basis. Like those women carried me through the good days, the bad days. They role modeled the behavior that I saw and thought to myself, that's who I want to be. I want to be just like them. They are suiting up and showing up for life every single day. They're not calling in sick. They're not making excuses. They're having fun. They have amazing lives. And you know, as those women kind of role modeled that for me, I wanted to role model that for somebody else and pass it along. And so, you know, I was making $9 an hour at the treatment center. It was not very sustaining. And you know, I had a lot of help from my parents, who always vowed that they would not enable my addiction, but they would always help enable my recovery. And they did that. And I'm so grateful that they never gave up and that I always knew I could pick up the phone and call. You know, my disease, obviously I had, you know, my life prior to getting sober, I had amazing moments. I had really low moments. But I never sought a contact with a higher power or a connection with a higher power. And it wasn't until I got sober and looking back and seeing that, you know, God really carried me through the entire time. And there's nothing that I haven't endured that I can look back and say, I'm not a better person because of it. And that I am who I am because of it. and there wasn't a reason for it. And, you know, in recovery, my life since I've you know, decided to get sober that day, that May 9th, 2010, you know, I found myself kind of working my way up in the recovery industry. You know, I was working as kind of basic tech jobs. I found myself kind of in an uncomfortable situation with a company that, you know, I didn't really care a lot about. I was overworked. I was underappreciated. And one day I decided I can't do this anymore. I've got to do something else. And I'll never forget driving home from work after I'd quit that day, thinking to myself, what am I going to do with my life? Am I starting from scratch again? And I had seen, through social media that, the original program that I had worked for, all those years ago was called Safe Harbor Treatment Center for Women. They're not all around anymore, but, Velvet, the owner, had these women who worked for her, and do business development. And their job was to kind of go out across the country and go to conferences and, create connection and, help drive business to the treatment center and also kind of let people know what their expertise is, create relationships, build relationships. And I thought to myself, I think I can do that. I think I would be really good at that. And so I called Velvet and I said, I want to come work for you. And this is another moment in my life where God has had a plan for me because, about a week prior to me calling Velvet, her previous business development person had put in her 2 weeks. And so she had opening. And she said, yep, come on over. And that was kind of the start of what's become, the next 12 years of my life and my career, I now work for a program in Newport Beach called Ocean Recovery. I worked my butt off from the day I started, and the owners decided to give me an equity share of the company.
Wow.
I get to travel and create meaningful relationships and take calls and talk to families of parents who are just like my parents who have no hope because their kid has been going in and out of treatment for 15 years or their daughter is experiencing an eating disorder and substance abuse, which is like a double, it's like a double weight. It's also during this time I met my husband who also works in my field. He owns another treatment center in here in Orange County. I have experienced a lot of heartache too. We had a lot of trouble getting pregnant. I had two miscarriages pretty quickly after we kind of started trying to have kids. The doctor told me that I really would not be able to have children without, science intervention. A week later, I discovered I was pregnant with our son, Finn. And I know it always happens that way, right?
By the way,
he is.
I showed my family, and they were like, "Oh my gosh, that boy is the cutest little boy I've ever seen."
He is a bright, shiny star in my life. I cannot imagine this world without a Finnegan O'Day in it. And I am, he is a gift from God. That is for sure. But there's also been a lot of heartache and stress. My recovery journey, I can say this, has not been perfect. Life's tough. Life as a mom's tough. Life as a working mom is tough. Life as a business owner is tough. Life as a wife is tough. And you know, unless you are constantly making sure your tool belt is well equipped to be able to handle those really difficult times, it's easy to you know, go back to your old coping ways, whether it's spending too much money or you know, eating disorder stuff or the substances. And so, you know, I've had a lot of things in my life in my recovery that have been hard. But one thing I am not without is a connection with my higher power. You know, like I kind of alluded to earlier, it didn't come naturally for me. I really had to practice. I had to really make a connection every single day with that higher power. And, you know, I talk to my higher power daily still. But I can tell you this, you know, every difficult time in my life that I look back to, I now look as a positive, whether it's, you know, getting fired from a job, even those, you know, 2 years of absolute hell I spent living in that crack house, I would not have the life that I have now without that. My recovery, and you know, the ripple effect that my recovery has on the people I talk to and the people that I help on a daily basis, and then the people those people help and the people those people help, you know, I can't see any other way besides absolute divine intervention for all of it, even the bad stuff. But again, I have to keep practicing at it, because it's really easy to forget. When the times are good and when things are easy, that is when it's really easy for me not to talk to my higher power. And those are the times that I, you know, my addiction is doing push-ups when I am not equipping myself on a daily basis, whether it's 10 years out, 15 years out, you know, 25 years out. You know, I am not immune to this disease. And I know that. You know, obviously I have a lot more to lose now. As you know, as I have a home and I have a career and I have a family. And so, you know, all the more reason to really remain vigilant about my recovery and everything that goes into it, including a connection with a higher power.
Absolutely. I would like to kind of talk about maybe probably a very big angel in your life, your husband, if we can talk about him, because I do think that in stories like this, one of the questions that comes to my mind is, you know, how did your husband react and how is that relationship? Because I would imagine that, hopefully, right, he is your hero and it takes a very strong person to, maybe take on that role and no, like, offense to you, it's just that in that situation, right, like when you've endured that abuse, maybe that would be hard on the spouse. I could only imagine, right? Maybe I'm wrong, but maybe go into a little bit of that because I know you probably will.
So, you know, my husband has his own history with substance abuse. He is a man in long-term recovery himself. And so, you know, I never really shied away from kind of the trials and tribulations of, you know, my disease and the things that happened to me there. But I can absolutely say that he is my champion. And, you know, his connection with his higher power, is what I always wanted. And, you know, it comes so naturally to him. And there's part of me that's really a little jealous of it. Because he relies on God so much, you know, every time we're going out of town, he starts our trip off with a prayer. And, you know, every night when I'm laying in bed, I hear him in the other room praying with our son and teaching him how to have a relationship with his higher power. And asking Finn, you know, what are you thankful for today? And, you know, hearing that little voice down the hallway. And, you know, Finn asked me questions about Jesus and God and heaven and all the things. You know, those are conversations I don't think I had with my parents. And I really regret that. I really do. And I know, and I certainly don't put it on my parents for, you know, not introducing. We did go to church occasionally and or temple. I think they tried to give us a little bit of everything, and allow us to kind of choose our path. And you know, at that point I was so overwhelmed with life that I didn't know how to rely on a higher power. And now, you know, I look at my husband and his strength. I know I can always go to him to have those difficult conversations, those times I'm feeling overwhelmed, those times I'm feeling like a shoddy mom, those times I'm feeling like a shoddy employee. Cause you know, you can't be 100 at everything. You just mm-hmm. can't. There are times somebody misses out, right? He's always there to pick me up, and to make sure to remind me about, you know, my worth and, what he's appreciative for. And also remind me to pray, you know, there are days I forget to do it. And you know, his kind of quiet,
like a giant.
Yes. It's like that he's certainly not a gentle giant. You know, if okay. you meet him, he has a big personality. It's kind of in your face, but the way that he holds himself, and the way he, holds up the people around him, you know, it makes me a better person. It makes me a better wife. It makes me a better mom. And when I'm, you know, those times I'm not feeling strong, I can rely on him to kind of help guide me and to remind me of what tools I do have, right?
Maybe a quiet angel or a quiet example.
Yeah.
I wanted to touch really quick too on, that phone call that you got from Todd. Was it Todd?
Todd DeGrasse.
Okay. Yeah. So certainly as far as your story goes, he can be an angel in your story. Yeah. Did you ever get any kind of clarification from him as to why or how he was able to reach out to you?
Yeah. So, you know, after I got sober, I really just, I wanted to reach out to him and just kind of let him know the impact that phone call really had on me. And so we were able to talk about it. And, you know, I think, his response when I asked him, like, what made you decide? You know, I think he, you know, I honestly think God told him to, there's no other explanation. We weren't that close. I hadn't seen him in ages. You know, I think something outside of himself compelled him to pick up the phone, to dial my number and to tell me, Heather, I think you've gone down this road about as far as you can go.
Well, I hope he's listening, and I can speak for all of us. Todd, thank you so much for having the strength and the courage to make that phone call. I think we're all in a position sometimes where maybe we feel a little nudge, a little whispering telling us that somebody needs to hear from us. And speaking for myself, there's been a lot of times where I've ignored that, right? And it's, I can't do that anymore. I need to be better about doing what God asked me to do. I wanted to ask one more thing or point out also, in recovery at the facility that you were at initially, you mm-hmm. said that there were other women around you who were also in recovery, but they were working, right? And you mm-hmm. looked to them and said, I want to be like that. Yeah. And then later on, you mention your husband and you said, I want to be like that. Mm-hmm. I think in life, it's so important for all of us, no matter where we're at in life, to look around us and find people that we want to be like and figure out, what do I have to do to be like him or like her? Yeah. And be diligent about doing those things like you have done. And, you know, that's the only way that we can become the people that we want to be.
Yeah.
Is we have to find examples. We have to find people that have done it and do what they do. And at the same time, realize that there might be people looking at me thinking, I want to be like that.
Yeah.
And what do I have to do for those people to be that example, right? To be that quiet example, to continue to be somebody that people can look at and think that they want to be like that. And yeah. I think that's so important, and it's so powerful in your story. I loved hearing you say that you want to
be like that. Well, you know, they always say, you know, in the rooms of Alcoholic Anonymous, they say stick with the winners, right? And you know, that it seems like such a simple thing and such a simple concept. You know, the reality is that, you know, surround yourself with people that you want to emulate. You know, surround yourself with the winners, surround yourself with the people that you look up to. And then, you know, again, you know, the other kind of, you know, there's a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous of just, you know, these are ways to live your life, whether you're sober or not. It's about giving back. It's about, you know, somebody freely gave me what they had, and now it's my job to freely give what I have to somebody else, to another alcoholic who's struggling. And that goes for, you know, my time. But it's also, you know, that role modeling of behavior where, you know, there's another saying where, you know, you act as if until you can actually do, right?
Mm-hmm. Fake it till you make it.
You fake it till you make it. You know, a part of that role modeling of the behavior is you don't know what do I fake, right? Like what is good behavior versus bad behavior? What is, you know, somebody who has, you know, good morals and good values and somebody who doesn't. And I think the reality is that the truth, you know, obviously comes from within. I think that there's a lot to be said about, you know, be the person that you want others to look up to, right?
Yep. Absolutely.
I love that.
And I love hearing about your perspective now. Life is so much about learning, right? And becoming better and being in the moment that you're in right now and being able to look back and recognize that your higher power was there the whole time and no longer looking at those trials as a hindrance in your life, but more as something that you had to go through to get to where you are now. And yeah. It's a lot of times that's hard for people to look back and think that way. And it only propels us forward more. So
yeah.
I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah. So something we like to end on is if anyone is going through a similar situation or a family member, any piece of advice for them that you would recommend or like to give?
Yeah, you know, the first thing I can say is don't wait. Don't wait to say something, even if it makes you uncomfortable, even if you think it's going to make them uncomfortable. The second is, you know, it is extremely overwhelming to navigate having to help somebody who obviously needs treatment, whether it's mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, eating disorder treatment, what have you. It is a very overwhelming industry, and it's really hard to know where to start. I readily make myself available to the world, you know, whether it's Facebook, the Facebook world, my cell phone number is printed on all of our websites. It's on my Facebook page, because, you know, one thing that I spend a lot of my time doing is helping families navigate, like, how to help somebody who cannot help themselves. You know, when somebody's struggling with substance abuse, like, their brain is hijacked. They're not thinking clearly. Often their bodies are completely physically addicted to the substance. They can't and shouldn't detox without medical intervention. And it's really hard to know where to start. If you don't have someone like me to call, reach out to your, the local SAMHSA number online has a lot of resources. Al-Anon is a great place to start too, if you're a family member who is struggling with somebody who struggles with substance abuse, and reach out to the people who have been there before you. That family friend, you know, who had their little daughter, Susie, go to treatment 10 years ago, but you're kind of embarrassed to call them to ask. I promise you, by making that phone call and connecting with that mom, she is, you know, her day is going to be better because of it, because she's going to be able to pass along that knowledge and the things that she went through to be able to help, you know, you as a mom or what have you. So, you know, don't wait to reach out. That's for sure.
Perfect.
Gave me chills.
And it sounds like you are giving people the green light to reach out to you also.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you can, if you want to get a hold of Heather, you can reach out to us and
you can reach out to them, or, you know, my number is as a resource on our website, which is www.oceanrecovery.com. And so you can always reach me there as well.
Perfect.
We'll that put is, all of the information that you just explained to.
It'll be in the show notes.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And then also, we like to give our guests an opportunity to be able to bear testimony of something that they know to be true. And I'd love to hear what you have to say.
What I know to be true is, despite some of my moments in life being extremely painful, God has always been there along the way. God would never give me something that I could not handle. I know this now. And I also know that in the moment, things that I think are negative or are I'm missing out on, actually, God's plan is so much better than I ever could think up for myself. Always. You know, whether it's the losing of the job or, you know, the door that you think is closing, God is always opening up a window. You really just have to open your eyes.
Thank you so much, Heather. That was awesome. And my life is better for now having knowing you. And thank you so much for sharing your story and opening up yourself. It's not easy to open up and to pour it all out there. Say, here it is.
Thank you to both of you for you know, utilizing this platform to bring on these people who have amazing stories. I just love what you guys are doing.
So many amazing stories out there, and you have one of them. So thank you for sharing, and we'll see y'all next week.
Thanks for joining us on Angels Among Us. You can find us on YouTube and wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow along for more stories of everyday miracles and reminders that angels are among us. If you have a story to share, please email or DM us with a brief summary. We'd love to hear from you. And remember, when we are waiting, God is working.